must unite what has been set asunder.
We are TFR. Truth Frequency Radio.
Hello, 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 ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the program. It is Monday. I know it's happened again. You always think it's going to happen to somebody else, but it's happened to us once again, ladies and gentlemen. For some reason, we're having some technical issues again. I don't know what's going on. I'm trying to do the show, but having some issues right now. But if you can hear me out there, appreciate you guys tuning in once again. This is, of course, Red Pill Reports radio broadcast. Today is the second day of February, and we are live. If it is bright outside and if it is in fact a weekday. So if it is in fact a weekday and it is bright outside, that means we're live right now. And as such, you can go over to truthfrequencyradio.com and get into the chat room. You'll also be able to listen along with the show in that room. But it's really nice to have some feedback in that chat room. We really like having you guys in there. Cannot appreciate all of you guys enough who tune in every day, making this part of your daily dose of deprogramming. And for those of you guys who are sharing the website with everybody, really do appreciate it. Same thing with those guys sharing the radio show around out there, getting us on the radar screens of new people all the time. Definitely appreciate that. Also, want to give you guys the heads up that you can go to redpillreports.com, and at the top of the page there, there's always going to be a show section. The show section is always going to have information about the guest that we will have in the second hour, as well as all of the pertinent headlines from around the world, all the stuff that we feel like is important to you. So, good place to go, redpillreports.com. Check out the show section. You'll be able to find out more about our guest today, who I am very excited to be bringing to the program. Mr. Stuart Rhodes is going to be joining us in about an hour, ladies and gentlemen. He is, of course, the founder of the Oath Keepers, oathkeepers.org. It's a beautiful, beautiful website. And these are the people who are going to save our republic, ladies and gentlemen. We cannot emphasize how much support we should be giving to the Oath Keepers. This is a group of law enforcement and military folks who understand the fact that they took an oath to the Constitution and actually what that means and how that's supposed to be dictating their interaction in society with all of us. And so Oath Keepers, fantastic organization, can't speak highly enough about them, and definitely excited to be welcoming Stuart Rhodes to the program a little bit later today, so do stick around for that. It's going to be a pretty big week, I have to admit. Karen Udis is going to be on tomorrow. She's obviously a pretty important whistleblower in terms of the IMF, big type banking type, you know, criminal organization. She's been behind the curtain, ladies and gentlemen. She's been behind the curtain, didn't like what she saw, became a whistleblower in terms of, well, the economic corruption that's going on all around us right now. So she's going to join us tomorrow for that. Have a very interesting discussion, try and figure out how we're going to dig ourselves out from underneath the corporate gangbangster cabal, is what I like to call these guys at this point. James Perloff's going to be joining us on Wednesday. We're going to be talking about the transition from the Cold War to the War on Terror and try and figure out where we are right now, because it seems like we're in this kind of murky gray area in between. Looks like they're trying to rebuild the Cold War again, and we're still knee-deep in the War on Terror right now. So, you know, were those things creations, you know, at the head of an agenda of some kind? Yeah, I think that's probably pretty substantial, significant, point that that's probably what's going on there. But anyway, James Perloff will be joining us Wednesday. Mr. Stan Deo will be back again on Thursday. We'll be talking about prophecy and all of the crazy current events, geopolitical stuff that's going on. I'm definitely going to ask him about the Muslim prophecy regarding the death of King Abdullah over there in Saudi Arabia and see what he thinks about everything that's going on there. And then we're going to give it another shot on Friday, ladies and gentlemen, with Richard Sauter joining us from Ecuador. Hopefully the connection will be better this time. We did have a pretty major internet outage on Friday. I apologize for all of that. It was not the NSA, apparently. It was actually my internet provider here in town. Second time in a couple of months that the whole internet's gone down for a short period of time. Just ridiculous. Just ridiculous. But that's what happened. Wasn't an attack necessarily, unless the NSA decided to take all of Comcast or Charter or whoever it is that I pay for my internet off the air. It could happen, I suppose. If you're the NSA, you have the capability. Did you guys see the game last night? Oh my gosh. Normally wouldn't even comment on it, but I have to admit I watched the game. Mostly I'm going to pretend it was out of research. It has nothing to do with the fact that I love Seattle, and it definitely doesn't have anything to do with the fact that I hate New England with the passion of a thousand white-hot burning suns. Didn't have anything to do with that. I wanted to watch it specifically because I wanted to know if there was going to be any kind of false flag type thing, which you never know about big crowds of people these days. You just kind of have to wonder. And then also, you want to watch the halftime show because A, it was going to be Katy Perry, and remember at the Grammys when she summoned Satan last year. So I kind of wanted to see, hey, what is she going to be doing at this particular, at this particular show. And she did not disappoint, ladies and gentlemen. I'll tell you what, if you're looking for Illuminati symbolism at the halftime show, I would imagine there will be some pretty big, YouTube video breakdowns later on today. But, some of the stuff that caught my mind right off the top of my head, topless pyramids. They were dancing on a big stage that, ended up looking like the floor from Solomon's Temple, the black and white checkerboard kind of thing. Very, very, very telling. And especially she's doing, parts of Dark Horse, which was of course the same song that she did at the Grammys when she summoned Satan. I don't know. She didn't necessarily summon Satan last night, but definitely was some telling symbolism in the halftime show. And then I just have to say too, I kind of have to wonder, there's a lot of conjecture about whether or not the NFL is rigged, whether or not, that, those results are decided beforehand. And, I gotta say, In my heart of hearts, honestly, it really looked like Seattle just gave that game away last night. There was nothing in the world that could have prevented Seattle from winning that football game. You had a miracle catch that happened just a few, plays before the last play of the game. You've got Mr. Falk, who pounded it all the way to the yard and a half line with, first and goal from the yard and a half on second down. You give it to Marshawn Falk three times. That's the end of the game. You just do it. You give it to the guy. You let him score. And they didn't do that. They chose to throw a really, really risky pass for no reason whatsoever, got intercepted, and obviously they lost the game. But I kind of started, looking around, and some of the people in the forums were suggesting that perhaps they threw it because they didn't want Falk to win the MVP. He would have ended up being on TV and blah, blah, blah. And there's obviously a little feud going on between him and the NFL. And man, I'll tell you, I don't know if that's what happened. I will say, without a doubt, was the worst call in any football game I've ever seen ever in my life. I've never seen more poor calling. And to me, that's just, you don't work that hard. With all the things that everybody on that team did to get them to that point, to throw it all away because of one bad call, that's just not something that happens. That's just not something that happens. So I'm kind of on the fence on this one, but I do feel like, Seattle really had the opportunity. They had the upper hand. They could have just won that thing handedly, and they decided not to for some reason. And, just kind of makes you wonder. But anyway, watched the game, thought it was pretty good. Nobody died. That's great. I'm happy that it's over. Now, of course, people will be talking about baseball season starting up in just a couple of weeks. So there you go, I guess. I'm not really all that huge into sports, you guys. I'm not saying that I watch every game. I don't even own a TV. I did just happen to watch that one last night because it's a big one, and you just never know what these people are going to do on television. So there you go. Morning to everybody in the chat room. By everybody, I mean Lex. Thanks for being in there this morning, guys. Anyway, we got some pretty big science and tech news, and we have some really big health news. I'm not going to get to that until after the bottom of the first hour here, or the bottom of the hour during this first hour. So in about 25 minutes. But Let's jump into some international news, because again, we try and keep you guys up to date on everything that happens Friday after the show all the way through the weekend. And there was obviously a lot of stuff that went down over the weekend. But late last week, and this was a story that missed me here, the United Kingdom's Royal Air Force had to actually scramble fighter jets on Thursday last week after a pair of nuclear-capable Russian bombers flew across a civilian air traffic corridor high above the English Channel. According to Yahoo News, the bombers had their transponders turned off, and British officials said making them invisible to many air traffic control systems, and the incident disrupted multiple flights and ended with the UK government demanding the Russian ambassador appear at the Foreign Office to explain the actions. We haven't heard any forthcoming information about an explanation from those actions, but it is possible that the event could be related to the European Union's vote to extend economic sanctions against Russia for an additional 6 months. Of course, that vote just happened last week. The sanctions were obviously imposed originally because of Russia's alleged invasion of Crimea and its support of its alleged support of the violent separatists in eastern Ukraine. But the EU voted to extend the sanctions regime in a week where violence has further flared in the Ukraine's Donbass region, and when evidence of Russia's military support of the rebels has mounted. So again, they're saying that there's been more and more support of the Russian separatists there by Russia, and of course that led to the further raising of the sanctions from the EU, and then so now Putin apparently sending nuclear bombers over the English Channel, and the UK needing to respond and chase them out. Apparently both of those planes were armed at the time. So again, still pretty testy there going on between NATO and Russia. There was a huge protest in Dublin over the weekend, actually shut the city down, brought the city completely to a halt. They say about 10,000 people gathered in Cork and some of the other surrounding cities. Now this Irish protesting has a lot to do with the fact that for the longest time they were not charged for their water, and now they're being charged for their water, and they are not happy about it. So they're peeling out into the streets and essentially protesting because they're going to essentially be forced into paying water taxes. So that's a big protest deal that's going on right now in the UK there in Ireland. The Westminster child abuse scandal getting deeper and deeper and deeper by the moment. And apparently now both Russian and U.S. intelligence apparently knew about a group of very powerful pedophiles operating in Britain, and the KGB hoped to blackmail them in exchange for information. And this is the long and the short of this whole story. It's a long article. I'm not going to get into the whole thing. But it does turn out that several groups, both the KGB and the CIA, had information about high-level pedophiles operating in the UK. And instead of doing anything to help the victims, right? That's not what our intelligence agencies are about. They're about gathering information and applying leverage. So that's what they did. They essentially compiled information about all these pedophile things, and instead of doing something about it, they used them. They used all that information in attempts to blackmail one another into getting themselves, more political power or more whatever it is that they were after. But again, that's pretty par for the course for the intelligence agencies around the world right now. Not really trying to help people, just trying to help themselves. But there you go. That's essentially what is going on right now. The CIA and the KGB both knew about and have got dossiers compiled about many, many, many people who are operating in the UK government pretty much over the last 40 years now. And hopefully we're going to start seeing something happen. And in relation to that, Theresa May is the Home Secretary there in the UK. She's said she's going to get an inquiry into this whole historical child abuse thing started. And the Sunday paper there, the Sunday People, has really been taking her to task. They actually started putting a countdown, a day count meter, in their papers, just counting the days that have gone by since when, Theresa May decided that she was going to do something about this. And, between then and now, it's been about 210 days where she hasn't actually done anything. Well, as of this weekend, she finally has announced that she's going to, start moving forward on this probe. So hopefully, we'll actually see some results from this whole pedophile investigation as Theresa May finally deciding now she's going to do her job. So, okay, We'll keep an eye on that. I think that a lot of these other stories that are going on around the news are trying to keep us away from the pedophile connection, especially the fact that Mr. Clinton is potentially involved with all of that. Anyway, Canada introduced on Friday new anti-terrorism legislation. Critics are now saying could give spy agencies sweeping powers that threaten the public civil liberties. So again, Canada now introducing the Anti-Terrorism Act 2015, which is being lauded as the most dramatic packages, most dramatic package of new laws since the Anti-Terrorism Act of 2001. Among the provisions of the legislation are that it would expand the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, CSIS, Canadian Security Intelligence Service, CSIS. Why? Boy, that name just seems really familiar to me, doesn't it? Is it just me? CSI? Why have I heard something really similar to that before? Ah, it's probably neither here nor there. Anyway, this bill would expand the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, CSIS, power to disrupt terrorism offenses and terrorist activity. It would make it easier for law enforcement agencies to carry out preventative detentions and allow them for longer time, make it easier for federal agencies to share information and give local law enforcement agencies power to disrupt terrorism offenses and terrorist activity, according to the governmental fact sheet related to the bill. Defending the measure in Richmond Hill, Ontario on Friday, Prime Minister Stephen Harper said that over the last few years, a great evil has been descending over the world. I don't think he's talking about the corporate banking cartel, but I'll just keep reading here. He says Canadians are targeted by those terrorists. I still don't think he's talking about the bankers right now, but I gotta keep going. For no other reasons that we are, other than that we are Canadians. Oh, okay, no. So we're falling back into they are attacking us because we are Canadians. That's apparently according to the Prime Minister of Canada there. He says they want to harm us because they hate our society and our values. They hate pluralism. They hate tolerance and the freedom that we enjoy. Because Canada, ladies and gentlemen, a lot of people might not know this out there, one of only two countries in the world that actually has freedom. One of only two. Them and America, of course. Obviously, the beacons of light on the hill, America and Canada. Obviously, you know, attacked because they are Canadians. We were attacked very similarly because they hated our freedoms. And, you know, it's just a shame that only two countries in the entire world are sovereign and have freedom. Of course, I'm being exceptionally facetious right now, ladies and gentlemen. And just ridiculous that they would after, I mean, it is 2015, guys, Canada, and you guys are falling back on the old George Bush, they hate us for our freedoms motif. Really? Are Canadians just that cold that they don't pay attention to anything? It's too cold there to pay attention? I don't think so. I think that's a pretty big insult to the people of Canada. But I agree with you there, Wolf. America! Woo! Go team! Okay, let's see. There's been the new ISIS video came out this weekend, which purported to show the beheading of the Japanese reporter. Did you guys all watch that? I haven't watched any of the beheading videos since the last ones were obviously green screen and fake. But apparently, 60-second video now ISIS has put out purports to show the beheading of the Japanese reporter, Kenji Goto, who, and of course this comes, at a gruesome end to a week of failed negotiations between ISIS and Japan. Is it real? I do not believe so. Again, you know, I just don't believe it. I don't believe it. Again, we're seeing the same jihadi John guy with the British accent, dressed in a black pajamas there, and he beheads a Japanese guy. I don't know if it's true. I don't even know. I believe it's probably not very true right now. Okay, let's move on to something more important, because ISIS, I don't believe, is all that important anymore. The Greek Prime Minister. There's been a lot that's come out. Obviously, we've talked quite a bit about the Greek Prime Minister, Alex Tsipras, who won the major election last Sunday, and on the back of these anti-austerity agenda platform, and was very successful. Obviously, won there in Greece, but he is still kind of playing cat and mouse right now with the leaders of the EU, and I'm starting to really enjoy the little back and forth that's becoming evident here between these two guys now. So he essentially came out this weekend, said he was going to meet with German Chancellor Angela Merkel when he got around to it. That's essentially what he says. So the cabinet member said, in due time. He's got kind of a busy schedule. He's really more keyed up on meeting the leaders of Italy and France first. So again, you know, Merkel is basically the head of the EU, and because she runs it by proxy from Germany. And the fact that Tsipras is just saying, well, I'll get around to it when I get around to it, I find that to be pretty funny. But Chancellor Merkel has said she has rejected the prospect of giving the new Greek government any kind of debt relief, which could obviously lead to rising tensions between Athens and its international creditors. Merkel says there has already been voluntary debt forgiveness by private creditors. Bank have already slashed billions from the Greek debt. And of course, this was Merkel speaking in an interview on the over the weekend. She says she does not envisage fresh debt cancellations. She also says Europe will continue to show its solidarity with Greece, as with other countries hit hard by the crisis, if these countries can carry out reforms and cost-saving measures. So there's the operative words right there. We will continue to show our solidarity with Greece, provided that they cow to the will of the EU and the IMF and the Troika, you know. So essentially they're saying we're not going to, you know, we're not going to do anything to relieve your debt. And the only way that we're going to stay unified with you is if you continue to carry out reforms and cost-saving measures. What does that mean? Well, it means austerity, which is the whole reason Tsipras won the election in the first place, is that the people are sick of austerity. So Tsipras kind of came back after hearing that, and he's made some statements now too. He says his obligation to respect the clear mandate of the Greek people with respect to ending policies of austerity and returning to a growth agenda in no way entails that we will not fulfill our loan obligations to the ECB or the IMF. So there you go. He says that regardless of the fact that he and the people there are demanding, you know, the end to the austerity policies and a return to some kind of growth agenda, he's going on record saying that that will not interfere with their obligation to fulfill these loan obligations to the ECB or the IMF. Okay. Now, how are they going to do this? Greece still has a debt of more than 317 billion euros. That's about $357 billion right now. That's more than 175% of the country's GDP, which is a record for the European Union. This also equates to a debt of about 34,000 euros per person, while the average wage in the country is only about 1,200 euros. So Athens wants to renegotiate the terms of a $240 billion bailout and says it will look to halve that debt. So how in the world is Greece going to be able to do that? Greece has already said it will not continue negotiations with the Troika Group, which has been responsible for monitoring the Greece economy since it received the bailout money. And the prime minister now also said there in Greece, he mentioned that Syriza will not be going back on its elected promise by asking for an extension to its bailout program. So, you know, we're kind of getting one piece of information from the finance minister there. We're getting some backwards talking from the new prime minister there. And it's just, you just don't know what's going to happen there. It just kind of makes you wonder. But I do think that you can only go one of two ways. The economy is either going to crash completely because they're going to instill so much new austerity that the people are going to completely revolt, or they're not. They're just going to back away. They're going to completely default on their debts. You know, if it was me, and this is what I think we should do on every one of these countries, just go country by country, find all these bankers and put them in jail, nationalize the currency systems again, start printing your own money, get out of the EU, start printing your own money, and then offer huge, huge loans in your local currency to anybody that wants to come in and set up shop and produce an actual product of actual value, something that actually makes something, a widget or whatever. Give those people the loans, jumpstart your economy, get these criminal corporate bankers off of the scene, because this is what the problem is that we're all being dragged down by this corporate criminal gangbangster. Blah. Anyway, okay. Huge fire erupted in Moscow over the weekend. This is bad, bad news, ladies and gentlemen. If you guys are like me, I have a pretty extensive collection of vintage Kindles. Some people call them books. I'm really into books. I like paper. But there was a massive fire in Russia's leading academic library over the weekend. This actually destroyed some 15% of their whole collection, or roughly 2 million unique historic documents. Some of the academics are saying that the scene resembles Chernobyl. So this was a huge, huge, huge academic library in Moscow. Most of the very, very important stuff In terms of what they actually keep there, were kept in the basement. So although there was a lot of water damage, a lot of people are thinking that they potentially will be able to recover some of the books, but we're talking about historical documents that go back hundreds of years, some of which are only single copies. You know, some of this stuff is you know, it's similar to the Library of Congress in terms of what these people have. It's essentially Moscow's version of the Library of Congress in the academic world. But this library was actually started back in 1918, and just unbelievable. So they have 49,000 researchers, 330 employees. It is the largest research center in Russia in the fields of social science and humanities. A collection consists of 14.2 million texts in both ancient and modern European and Asian languages, including rare 400-year-old editions. It's also one of the biggest collections of Slavic language books in the country. As I said, founded back in 1918. Hopefully they didn't lose too much of that stuff. But I'll tell you, man, I'm still really upset about the library at Alexandria, because I think every time we lose a library like this, it is bad news, ladies and gentlemen. We lose a lot of history. We lose a lot of our capabilities, and it's just no good. No good whatsoever. We are going to have to go to a break in about a minute. I did guide to give you guys a heads up. There is some pretty amazing tech news coming out today. I want to talk about BitTorrent's new project. It's called Maelstrom. A lot of people might be familiar with BitTorrent right now, and you know, how torrents work and things like that. But they're talking about doing something completely new with the internet, using the same technology that we use to distribute torrents right now. Absolutely unbelievable. And man, I'll tell you, there's another, I think this is kind of a frightening story about some researchers at Harvard and what they have now been able to do with human DNA. I don't know about you guys, but this, every one of these stories that kind of leading us down this brave new world road starts to kind of freak me out here a little bit. This is one of those types of stories, guys. This is going to be one of those ones where you're going to be like, what in the world? And the capability that we're going to have because of this breakthrough is just unbelievable. We also have some great health stories right now. It does look like all of us are probably going to die of the measles. Oh no, wait. No, check that, reverse it. It looks like probably no one is going to die of the measles, because no one really ever does die of the measles. But that's not what the media wants you to think. The media wants you scared, so we're going to talk about that when we get back. And also, science could have had it wrong when it comes to cold weather and getting sick. We're going to talk about that when we get back, too. So keep it right here, guys. We have a 3-minute break, and then we'll be right back.
Chris and Sheree Geo here, founders of Truth Frequency Radio. We just wanted to take a moment to thank all of you for making TFR the biggest and the best independent radio station out there.
When we first entered the alternative media scene in 2009, we were really taken aback by the amount of infighting, backbiting, fear-based reporting, and ego-driven personalities. That's when we knew we had to set ourselves apart and set a new standard in broadcasting. And thus, TFR was conceived as a listener-supported station with no corporate or outside influence and limited commercial interruptions.
You can support our efforts by signing up for a VIP membership at truthfrequencyradio.com/signup or by making a donation at truthfrequencyradio.com/donate.
For less than $4 a month, you can ensure that TFR continues broadcasting for years to come. Real people, real radio.
Wherever you are, make it TFR.
Big business has discovered the preparedness market, and that makes it difficult to know where to go and who to trust. MyPatriotSupply.com is owned and operated by patriots just like you, has the best prices on storable food, non-GMO seeds, water filtration devices, home canning equipment, survival and self-reliance books, and more. MyPatriotSupply.com has old-fashioned values and the absolute best customer service in the industry. Look for the deal of the day, unique affordable survival supplies that fit anyone's budget. Get same-day shipping on all orders and free shipping on orders over $49. Call 866-229-0927, 866-229-0927, or visit MyPatriotSupply.com for emergency preparedness, self-reliance, and food independence. Shop with a name you know and a name you can trust. Before it's time to survive, it's time to prepare. MyPatriotSupply.com.
Did you know there are 3 million edible food plants on Earth, and none have the nutritional value of the hemp plant? HempUSA.org offers you hemp protein powder. It does not contain chemicals or THC, is non-GMO, and is 100% gluten-free. Hemp protein powder burns fat, builds muscle, contains 53% protein, and feeds the body the nutrients it needs. Call 888-910-4367 and see what our powder, seeds, and oil can do for you. Only at HempUSA.org. Wouldn't it be nice to have one product that replaces more than 10, saving you space, time, and money? HempUSA.org has a complete full-spectrum vitamin mineral detox formulation called Micro Plant Powder Gold. Micro Plant Powder Gold contains 101 vitamins, minerals, probiotics, and iodine, has a 100-year shelf life, and is a perfect addition to any storage shelter. Make Micro Plant Powder Gold your choice. Call 888-910-4367 or visit HempUSA.org today.
Staunching Tyranny with Jim and Jeff Staunch.
Monday on Truth Frequency Radio.
Nice to have some feedback. I totally wanted to step back and talk about one thing I saw in the chat room. Lex was talking about the fact that the readers or the Kindles are completely government ready for censorship and elimination of books. And I could not possibly agree more with you, brother. That's why I don't do those. And again, you can have the biggest book collection you want on your Kindle, but if you run out of electricity, well, there goes all your books. I'd rather have paper in my hands, something I can trade and share with my friends and actually get some enjoyment out of. And I'll tell you, a book is always different every time you read it too, because you have changed in the process. So I love going back and rereading books over and over and over again. And I stare at a computer screen enough as it is. You know, I don't need to look at it for a book. That's just not, that doesn't seem enjoyable to me when I'm trying to get away from something like this. Plus, I don't want to take the Kindle in the bathroom. We'll just leave it at that. I want to talk quickly a couple more international stories before we jump on. There was a huge rally in Madrid on Saturday. More than 100,000 people basically came out into the streets to show strength and support in the fledgling radical leftist party there, which hopes to emulate the success of Greece's Syriza party in the Spanish general elections later this year. The police say it was about 100,000 people. Podemos, who is the party leader on that side. He is a political science instructor. He has a ponytail, 36 years old, kind of a rolled up shirt, jean kind of guy. Lots and lots and lots of support. He actually put the number closer to 300,000 in the streets of Madrid on Saturday. So again, you know, we talked about the result of the Syriza successful election in Greece and whether or not that would potentially, you know, boil over into other neighboring communities where other people are still under the thumb of the IMF and under the EU, and they are sick of it. And that's exactly what we're seeing. Also, it needs to be pointed out that shelling in the eastern Ukrainian city of Donetsk continued pretty much nonstop over the weekends. Lots of shells landing in civilian areas, even as mediators talked on Saturday. Militia and Kiev forces are pretty much right now fighting for strategic areas in the eastern side of Ukraine still. So that hasn't changed. We're still seeing a lot of a warring going on there. But as an ancillary note, or as a conciliatory note, I guess, the Islamic fighters have now admitted that the Kurdish forces have managed to take Kobani after an intensified U.S.-led air campaign over the end of the week and the weekend. So again, we've had some varying reports coming out about the success of the Kurdish fighters there in Kobani, retaking Kobani, and it does look like now ISIS has officially thrown in the towel on Kobani there. So that is good news as you're paying attention to what's going on in Iraq and Syria with ISIS. Okay, let's move into some national news right now. I do have to give this one particular heads up. Back in November, Richard Mack's wife, Dawn, was actually hospitalized with a pretty serious medical issue. And then in early January, Richard Mack himself suffered a heart attack that required surgery. And because both of these people are self-employed, they don't really have medical insurance, and they are kind of in need of some assistance. So in the news section here today, and if you go to cspoa.org, there is a GoFundMe.com site So if anybody has a little bit extra they can spare for the CSPOA, Richard Mack and Don Mack, they could definitely use our assistance right now. And again, these are the kind of people that we want to support. They're out on the front line doing what is best for our country, and they're kind of in a pickle right now. And I would really like to just highly recommend, if you guys can do it, please go there and support Richard and Don Mack right now, please. Police are now seeking a Department of Homeland Security grant to deal with some extremists, and these extremists are in Missoula, Montana. They are called the Rainbow Family. They're essentially a loosely affiliated hippie group, which, you know, really focuses on nonviolent peace and love. Obviously would be, you know, right at the top of the list for domestic terrorists in terms of Department of Homeland Security. So the mayor of Missoula now signed off this week on a proposal that, if approved, would net the Missoula Police Department nearly a little over, actually, $250,000 from the Department of Homeland Security to purchase a mobile command unit that would be used to spy on the Rainbow Family, which is, of course, as I mentioned, listed as an extremist organization in the proposal. The unit will also be used by other first responders during emergencies and natural disasters. So again, Missoula, Montana doesn't have a lot to do with their time. They're very bored. And apparently they also would really like to have an MRAP. So what they're doing is they're focusing on this family called the Rainbow Family, which again describes itself as a nonviolent group spreading the message of peace and love, which is only actually met twice in Montana in the last 15 years, once in 2000 and once in 2013. And the extent of the threat posed by the group is that one of its gatherings was described by the U.S. Forest Service as quote-unquote rowdy. So, okay, so these guys get together every few years in the woods and they get rowdy. And so for that, Missoula needs $250,000 MRAP. That's essentially what is going on right now in Missoula. So if you're in Missoula, I swear, I don't know what to tell you. I would write these people a letter. Okay, the ability to travel in the United States, probably something many of us are concerned about right now, but could become very much more restrictive. TSA is announcing it will soon be enforcing new identification standards in American airports. This is going to begin in 2016. Passengers attempting to pass through the federal TSA checkpoints will be subject to the requirements of the Real ID Act. To that end, the TSA will put higher scrutiny on travelers' identities and will also only accept a federal passport or a Real ID card, which is issued by the state to meet federal requirements. Passengers will not be allowed to fly through an American airport without submitting to the advanced federal specifications. So you either are going to have an ID or one of these new Real ID cards. The Real ID cards obviously tie in a lot of unique personal identifiers. These then go and are, you know, stored at the cloud centers from the NSA. But of course, it's your full name, date of birth, social security, your scanned signature, and other identifiers. But again, all of that's already on your passport right now. The, both of these cards have biometric data, which would be the front-facing digital photograph of your face, which is ultimately used with facial recognition software. So again, yeah, that's exactly it, Wolf. You're going to have your papers here coming up pretty soon. So welcome to Nazi Germany. And a lot of states are still kind of lagging behind the whole Real ID in action thing. So you might actually be in a state that doesn't have Real ID compliant driver's license or state IDs yet. So you might want to figure that out before you try and travel next year, because we might be getting into a pinch point now. A fourth grader in Kermit. Normally I would hang this story way down in the funny, weird, you know, good news section, but I couldn't skip it because it did happen in the States and it's just so stupid that I had to bring it up. But a fourth grader in Kermit, Texas was suspended for making quote unquote terroristic threats because he allegedly told a classmate that he had a magic ring that could make the boy disappear. According to the Kermit Elementary School officials, the 9-year-old Aiden Stewart told a classmate that he possessed a magic ring forged in Mount Doom, which is, of course, the fictional location from The Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings series. So his father was pretty surprised that this young man got suspended. He did go back to the authorities at the school and assured them that his son lacked the magical powers necessary to threaten his friend's existence. But he did go on to say that if he did have those powers, he was sure that he would bring him right back. But apparently the Kermit Elementary principal Roseanne Greer said she couldn't comment on the suspension because all student stuff is confidential. That's a direct quote. But Stewart said that she told the newspapers that any and all threats to a child's safety, including magical ones, would be taken seriously by the school. So I don't even know what to say. I mean, seriously, the 9-year-old boy potentially threatening another kid with a magic ring forged in Mount Doom, and they suspended him. That's what's wrong with America, ladies and gentlemen. Mitt Romney will not be pursuing a third presidential run. That's as much of that story as I'm going to cover. Yellowstone supervolcano on verge of eruption. This story comes out of IntelliHub and was actually kind of startling. As of the 29th of January, so just a couple of days ago, Hank Hessler, who is a park geologist, he is stationed at Yellowstone National Park. He's been there since 2002. He came out and publicly announced and put only a 2-week time frame for the supervolcano located under the park to erupt. So again, a park geologist stated in Yellowstone since 2002 has now come out on record and said that not only is the supervolcano under Yellowstone going to blow up, that it's likely that it's going to happen in the next 2 weeks. So what would that happen? What would happen if that happened? Well, pretty much a location of about 1,000 miles around the park would be pretty much gone. And Michio Kaku, the famous physicist, goes on television all the time, also pointed that out. Probably be a United States ender. So, you know, is it going to happen in the next 2 weeks? Kind of difficult to say. But I don't know, maybe having an earthquake plan together if you're kind of out within 1,000 miles of Yellowstone might be a good time. I don't know. But on the 4th of March last year, IntelliHub actually came across some information. Now, it was from an unnamed source, but they did report that the White House had ordered the United States Geological Survey to suppress earthquake swarm data in the region and to hide what might be coming from the general public. And again, this is kind of where it starts to get scary, because that would be an extension level event potentially if it does go off. So I don't know. Is it going to happen? Who knows? I'm not trying to get anybody all scared. It's just unusual when you actually have a geologist who works at Yellowstone saying, yeah, things might get real bad and real bad in a hurry. Definitely something worth paying attention to. Let's see, a bill moving its way through the Texas legislature right now would allow lethal force to be used against students without risking any legal repercussions for the teacher. So essentially what we're doing is we're providing amnesty or prosecution protection from any teacher that happens to kill a student under their protection. The House bill is 868, or the Teacher Protection Act, which again affords educators legal immunity in the unlikely event that they happen to kill any of their students during school-sanctioned events. Kind of unusual, because Texas already has some pretty staunch self-protection acts, but this particular bill goes a little bit further, saying that if a teacher hurts a student, not necessarily who was threatening them, but who was threatening somebody in their class, that would be okay. That's not typically how self-defense works. That's you kind of borderlining on vigilanteism there. But again, if House Bill 868 does pass in Texas, immunity for teachers who potentially hurt or kill a student in their stead. Scary times there in Texas. The National Rifle Association filed lawsuits this week against Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and Lancaster, claiming that the city's local gun ordinances defy state laws. The lawsuits are made possible by new state legislation, which just took effect last week. So hopefully we'll see some gun laws in terms of citywide gun laws there in Philadelphia start going by the wayside, because, again, not in keeping with state law. So that is good news, I guess, for people of Philadelphia there, if you're into gun rights and things like that, which a lot of people are. Let's see here. Going into some economic news here real fast. I want to jump over and see what the Dow is doing right now. We're up about 76 points in early trading. S&P is hanging out right at 2,000. Looking at the commodities, gold, not doing too great, but not too bad. It's 1273 right now. We're down about $5 today. 1728 for silver right now. Let's look at the euro against the dollars. It's sitting at 1.13 right now, up just a teeny tiny bit. And Bitcoin sitting at $220 right now. So that is what is going on in the markets. A lot of speculation about what's going to be on in the gold markets this week. analysts are expecting a lot of volatility because markets are supposedly going to be adjusting to monetary policy expectations and some more geopolitical uncertainty. Obviously, the Greece situation is playing into that, whether or not they decide to leave the euro. I also think you've got a lot of people who are buying the dips, selling the highs, and watching that $30 band or so, which gold has been kind of bouncing around for the last week. It's a good way to make some money. Buy the dips, sell the highs. But I think a lot of safe haven buying will probably be coming out later this week. There's going to be some pretty significant economic indicators coming out from around the world, PMIs, stuff like that. So we'll see as the week goes on what exactly gold is going to be doing. The U.S. personal spending actually declined for the first time in about 20 months in December. This is fueling concerns over the strength of the economy, and official data showed this all on Monday this week. In a report, the Commerce Department said that the personal spending fell 0.3% in December, worse than the expected fall of 0.2%, and personal spending rose to 0.5% in November, and then they revised that figure down because they had actually reported a 0.6% gain in November, so they revised that back down to 0.5. Consumer spending is pretty much the biggest source of U.S. economic growth, accounting for as much as two-thirds of the economic activity. So again, seeing the personal spending starting to fall, not necessarily a good sign. Bitcoin price down over 5% this Sunday. It appears we are returning to a long-term downtrend, which has been in place and holding fairly steady in the path since summer of 2014. For a couple weeks at the end of January, Bitcoin looked like it was going to be optimistically rising there, but a strong upturn in price. It seemed many that we may have finally broken the digital currency's long-term decline in value, but that did not seem to really take hold in January. As we can see now, you can look at a 180-day chart of Bitcoin, and it does look like it's a pretty steady downward trend. The $200 mark, which we're above right now, I mentioned Bitcoin sitting at about 220 right now. $200 is pretty key support level with a lot of psychological significance for traders. And again, if we get down below that, difficult to say where the bottom may end up, but Bitcoin again trading at about 220 right now. Let's see here, what else should we talk about? The economic situation in Venezuela has deteriorated even more. We talked about it a little bit last week. There was the woman who makes her entire living by standing in line to buy toilet paper for people. That's all she does. 18 hours a day, she makes phone calls to her neighbors, find out who needs what, and just stands in line. But obviously, Venezuelans are going through a lot right now. Chronic food shortages, the country's economic crisis is getting deeper and deeper. As a result of that, the government has now authorized its armed forces to use lethal force against protesters that they believe their lives are at risk during the demonstrations. Most people down there, the ordinary people, have been angry for months at having to wait in long lines and pay increasingly higher prices for basic goods like food, meat, rice, butter, toilet paper, stuff like that. And if the shortages persist, the government fears that people may become more desperate, if not more violent. So the country's defense minister said the new rules are in response to 3 months of intense street protests during the closeout of last year. And a Human Rights Watch report, documenting Venezuelan security forces, says that they were using unlawful force in response to anti-government demonstrations, severely beating unarmed protesters and shooting them at point-blank range. The scale of rights violations that were found in Venezuela and the collaborative study of security forces and justice officials in committing them shows that these are not isolated incidents, and they are excesses, and they are not just a few rogue actors, apparently. Again, this is Jose Miguel Vivanco, who's America's director at Human Rights Watch. He says, rather, they are part of an alarming pattern of abuse that is the worst we have ever seen in Venezuela. So again, Venezuela not in the news cycle much right now, but they are having a very tough time down there. And I agree with you, Lex, in the chat room that I think there's probably some direct CIA involvement with everything that's going on down there right now. Let's see here. Moving into some tech news right now. There's a couple of stories I wanted to talk about for sure. BitTorrent's new project, Maelstrom. This is a pretty amazing piece of technology. So I'm sure a lot of you guys know, but when you enter a URL and you hit the enter button, right, your computer reaches out to a server someplace in the world to access a website. Sometimes a site is stored on a few servers for redundancy or for load balancing, but the model is functionally pretty much the same across the board. BitTorrent, which is the company behind the popular file sharing protocol, is looking to change the way that websites are hosted by keeping the data not on a centralized server, but on the home computers of users. This is pretty neat. The site then would be split up into pieces, just like a file shared via torrent, that BitTorrent calls this system Project Maelstrom, and it's getting very close to reality, apparently. The Maelstrom project is built on a modified version of Chromium, which is the open source project that backs Google's Chrome browser. And if we extend the file sharing analogy to Project Maelstrom, the modified browser is basically your torrent client, okay? So you enter a web address, the browser connects to a swarm of users already accessing the site who have pieces of it ready to send over. The bits are assembled in the final product and displayed normally. If it works as intended, you won't even notice a difference between the functionality of the sites. The torrent browser is going to be able to access regular web pages via the internet, but it's mainly for those so-called torrent web pages. The main advantage here will be that the scalability of this program surpasses anything we have on traditional server infrastructure. When a site gets hit by a lot of traffic today, the server has to devote more and more bandwidth to serving that content, which can easily saturate the pipes. In the case of a distributed denial of service attack or a DDoS attack, the website can actually be knocked off for hours or days. A torrent web page should actually become more reliable as it is accessed more. More seeds mean more speed and accessibility. So this is the opposite of what a DDoS attack would do. The notable drawback to the Project Maelstrom would be that it's relative difficulty in keeping very or new or unpopular sites online. So when a new torrent page is created, there's only one source of the data, probably with nowhere near the power of a dedicated web server. So the content is the first seed, the creator's the first seed, and the next person to visit is the second seed, and the third person then has two sources to download from, and then beginning they become the third seed. So you see how this kind of spreads in a non-controlled, non-centralized way, just like a torrent does, and it can get stupid fast when there are enough seeds. So the decentralized nature of the Project Maelstrom would make it nearly impossible to take down a website as long as users kept seeding it, which obviously seems like a perfect match for the Pirate Bay, right? The platform obviously presents some ethical questions, of course, because what if a legitimately terrible or illegal site were hosted in the Maelstrom? There might not be any way to take it down. This is something law enforcement already has to deal with Tor, but Project Maelstrom has the potential to be much, much faster and much easier to use. BitTorrent thinks that the content providers will get on board with Maelstrom as a way to reduce costs. Again, they're not going to have to be keeping track of their servers and things like that and keeping those things cooled all the time. For example, so if Netflix can detect when a user is connecting through a Maelstrom-enabled browser, it could save money by serving video content through a swarm of multiple users rather than pushing separate streams out to everybody individually. It would make like a content delivery network on steroids. And BitTorrent is going to find out if Maelstrom will be used for good or evil fairly soon, because a consumer version of the product is going to be expected this year. I think that is super rad. We are using technology to further decentralize the internet and at the same time making the portions of the internet that we really want to be able to access almost impossible to take down. I love it. Okay, let's also talk about this other scary story. It is a brave new world, ladies and gentlemen. A bioengineer and geneticist at Harvard's Weiss Institute have successfully stored 5.5 petabits of data. That's 700 terabytes on a single gram of DNA, smashing the previous DNA data density record by more than 1,000 times. This work carried out by George Church and Sri Kasturi basically treats DNA just like any other digital storage device. Instead of binary data being used or encoded as magnetic regions on a hard drive platter, strands of the DNA that store 96 bits are synthesized, which each of the bases, T, G, A, and C, representing a binary value, T and G equals 1, A and C equals 0. To read the data stored in DNA, all they have to do is sequence it, just as you were sequencing the human genome, and convert each of the TGAC bases back into binary. And to aid with the sequencing, each strand of DNA has a 19-bit address block at the start. The red bits in the image below, there's an image there you can see. So a whole vat of DNA can be sequenced out of order and then sorted into usable data using the addresses. This is crazy! Scientists have been eyeing DNA as a potential media storage for a long time for three very good reasons. It's incredibly dense. You can store one bit per base, and a base is only a few atoms long. It's volumetric, beaker rather than planar, which is a hard disk, and it's incredibly stable where other bleeding edge storage mediums need to be kept in sub-zero vacuums. DNA can survive for hundreds of thousands of years in a box in your garage. It's only with recent advances in microfluidics and labs on chip that synthesizing and sequencing DNA has become an everyday task, though. While it took years for the original human genome project to analyze a single human genome, which was some 3 billion DNA base pairs, modern lab equipment with microfluidic chips can do it in hours. So now this isn't to say that Church and Kasuri's DNA storage is fast, but it's exceptionally fast when you're thinking about it in terms of very long-term archival. But just think about this for a second. 1 gram of DNA can store 700 terabits of data. That is 14,000 50 gigabit Blu-ray discs in a droplet of DNA that would fit onto your pinky. To store the same kind of data on hard drives, the densest storage mediums in use today, you would need 233 3-terabit drives, which would weigh a total of 151 kilos. In Church and Kasuri's case, they have successfully stored 700 kilobytes of data in a DNA, and they actually put Church's latest book into this DNA and proceeded to make 700 billion copies, which they claim jokingly makes it the best-selling book of all times. But they totaled 44 petabits of data. I mean, this is just absolutely mind-boggling. It's also worth noting that it's possible to store data in the DNA of living cells, even though it's only for a short time. But storing data in your skin could soon become a fantastic way of transferring data securely. I don't even know what to say about this, ladies and gentlemen, because this is so startling to me to think, they're looking for the synthesis of biology and computers. And wouldn't you know it, that synthesis already exists in our own DNA. We are already computers. We are already capable of storing ridiculous amounts of information in our DNA. That's just mind-boggling to me. It's just crazy. But anyway, that is what's going on in your world right now. There are more tech stories out there. There's quite a few health stories too. I'll see if I can jump through one of these really quick. I'll let you guys know I don't hear any bumpers today, so I don't know what's going on with the clock. So we're just kind of muddling ahead. But there is a great story also in the news section today about 9 herbs and spices with proven health benefits. Cinnamon can balance your blood sugar. Garlic can slow atherosclerosis. Rosemary can protect your eyesight. Oregano reduces viral activity. Boy, that's an understatement and a half. Anyway, get into redpillreports.com. Check out the show section. Stuart Rhodes is going to be joining us in just a few minutes. Lots of good stuff to be talking about in the next hour and plenty of news that you guys can go back over and peruse. We will see you in just a few seconds after this break, guys, in the chat.
Chris and Sheree Geo here, founders of Truth Frequency Radio. We just wanted to take a moment to thank all of you for making TFR the biggest and the best independent radio station out there.
When we first entered the alternative media scene in 2009, we were really taken aback by the amount of infighting, backbiting, fear-based reporting, and ego-driven personalities. That's when we knew we had to set ourselves apart and set a new standard in broadcasting. And thus, TFR was conceived as a listener-supported station with no corporate or outside influence and limited commercial interruptions.
You can support our efforts by signing up for a VIP membership at truthfrequencyradio.com/signup or by making a donation at truthfrequencyradio.com/donate.
For less than $4 a month, you can ensure that TFR continues broadcasting for years to come. Real people, real radio.
Wherever you are, make it TFR.
Did you know that the blue lotus flower was used by the ancient Egyptians as an aphrodisiac to experience feelings of euphoria and ecstasy? And ecstasy. And ecstasy. Did you know that Thai kratom was used by the Buddhist monks to produce a relaxing and dreamlike state? Did you know San Pedro cactus was used by the Native Americans to quest for visions and heal the body? Bouncing Bear Botanicals is your number one supplier of rare and sacred plants and a proud sponsor of Truth Frequency Radio. By clicking on the banner at truthfrequencyradio.com, you can learn more about a vast selection of entheogens, including Amanita muscaria, also known as the sacred mushroom. So click on the banner at truthfrequencyradio.com, and you'll also get up to $40 off your next order.
Judith Baker was once a promising science student who dreamed of finding a cure for cancer. This exposé is an account of how she strayed from a path of mainstream scholarship to a life of espionage in New Orleans with Lee Harvey Oswald. In her narrative, she offers extensive documentation on how she came to be a cancer expert and what led to her involvement in the development of a biological weapon that Oswald was to smuggle into Cuba to eliminate Fidel Castro. Details on what she knew of Kennedy's impending assassination and her belief that Oswald was a deep cover intelligence agent who was framed for an assassination he was actually trying to prevent are also revealed. Me and Lee by Judith Baker. Special JFK 50th Anniversary Signed Limited Edition. $30 including shipping. Limited number of these available. Order your copy today at federaljack.com/store.
This is Truth Frequency Radio.
No hate, no hype, no fear. Real people, real radio.
I'm sorry about that extra little break right there. I'm having trouble reaching out to Mr. Stuart Rhodes right now, so we're just going to kind of bear with me here for just a second while we try and get these calls to go through with all of your help and encouragement. Send me some good vibes, ladies and gentlemen, so we can get Mr. Stuart Rhodes on today. Looking forward to speaking with him about the Oath Keepers and about some of the initiatives that they've got going on right now. But as I said, miracle of modern technology, live radio, sometimes things just don't work out the way that you would like them to. So it's kind of been the par for the course here recently, ladies and gentlemen. So again, going to try and continue to reach out to Mr. Stuart Rhodes there. And until I can get in touch with him or perhaps my esteemed colleagues at Red Pill Reports can reach out to him and see if we can't get him, keep him there.
Hello.
Hello, is this Stuart Rhodes?
This is.
Hey, Stuart, this is JD from Red Pill Reports. How are you doing today, sir?
Hey, JD, how you doing? Yeah, well, my Skype did not work, unfortunately.
That's okay. Sometimes that happens, my friend. It is the beauty of live radio, but we are live right now. I want to appreciate or tell you how much I appreciate you joining us on the program today.
Welcome.
Wonderful, wonderful to hear your voice. Obviously, you know, people at redpillreports.com, our listeners know, how much we support you guys. We have an Oath Keepers link on our website and we talk about you guys and also the CSPOA all the time because we're in a pickle in this country, Stuart Rhodes. I don't know how else to describe it right now, but we, I think, have really been, well, taken over by some pretty evil people. I think the obviously the Constitution has been subjugated, I guess would be the correct word. But anyway, want to get into all that with you today, and I appreciate you being here. For ladies and gentlemen out there listening, for those of you guys who don't know who Stuart Rhodes is, he is the founder and president of the Oath Keepers. You can go to oathkeepers.org and check out their website, one of the best ones on the internet. He graduated magna cum laude from the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, where his honor thesis focused on the political theory of James Madison. He also, while attending UNLV, taught rape prevention and street crime survival as a voluntary instructor for the UNLV Women's Center there. I also worked as a professional sculptor. I've seen some of your work, sir. It is exceptionally, exceptionally impressive, I have to say. But he also worked as a state-certified concealed firearm instructor. He's worked for the Ron Paul organization staff in D.C. Also graduated from Yale's law school in 2004. Just absolutely ridiculous amount of accolades. Stuart, is there anything else before we get into the Oath Keepers and that organization that people should know about you and your history, sir? Stuart, can you hear me? Oh, my goodness. It looks like we might have lost Stuart, ladies and gentlemen. I apologize about that. Let me see if I can get him back on the horn here. Always good times with the live radio, like doing it. Let's see here. Recent. Let's call. We'll try that one again. Add him back onto the group call here, and then we'll see if we can get into the phone lines here. Good stuff. And not having it right now, ladies and gentlemen. All right. Bear with me here, guys. I'm doing the best that I can. Sometimes the radio show is just how it goes. You know what I mean? And what is this? This is hosts. Where's my phones at? Okay. Well, if any of those, now we're getting a ringtone. We'll see if we can get,
This is Stuart.
Hey, Stuart. I'm sorry, man. We are having all kinds of technical difficulties now. Well,
Is it on my end or your end?
It's difficult to say. It's difficult to say at this point, but you're coming in loud and clear right now. And, I don't know if you heard, I gave a little bit of your bio, but I was wondering if perhaps you might, just talk about yourself for just a second. Give us the rundown on who you are. And then, we'll talk about how you developed the Oath Keepers organization after that, if you would, sir.
Yeah, sure. I served as a paratrooper in the Army, and I was disabled. And then after that, I worked for Congressman Ron Paul after college, and then I went to Yale Law School. That was where I got my law degree. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty much, you know, the rundown on me, just an average veteran, I think. A big motivator for me to begin Oath Keepers, a huge wake-up call was the gun confiscation that happened during Hurricane Katrina, where you yes. had nationalized police from all over the country. National Guardsmen, all of them obeying blatantly unconstitutional orders to disarm, you know, peaceable gun owners who were just trying to protect themselves. Mm-hmm. And then, but then even more fundamental than that was the massive escalation in the militarization of the police and the growth of the, you know, Department of Homeland Security and other national security, you know, excused growth in power. Post 9/11, and a big, big one for me was the detention of Jose Padilla and Yasser Hamdi, two American citizens who were detained as unlawful combatants post 9/11, and the laws of war, which is a direct violation of our Constitution.
Right.
So it's just, you know, to me, that's where they kind of crossed the Rubicon, and the Supreme Court unfortunately upheld that in 2004 in the Hamdi decision as somehow being constitutional. So I realized we were almost like post-constitutional America.
Right.
And we needed to have some serious brakes put on the escalation of the police state, give us time to fix the republic. And that's what I thought of Oath Keepers. We can appeal to those who've taken the oath, both current serving and retired. Us veterans have a serious responsibility as well. Then we can throw a big monkey wrench into their plans if we can get people to do what needs to be done. And with the current serving, that is, you know, the absolute obligation to refuse unlawful orders, just the same as they have an obligation right now to refuse orders to shoot women and children, for example, in the military.
Right.
You know, during the My Lai massacre, they should have refused those orders. And Warrant Officer Thompson, who stopped the My Lai massacre, is an example of an Oath Keeper. You know, Lieutenant Cowie, the one who followed orders and shot women and children, is or claimed that he was following orders, is an example of an Oath Breaker. Pretty clear. You know, stark comparison there that people can understand.
Mm-hmm.
But the same thing applies during Katrina. They were given orders, and it's not a defense to say I was just following orders and I should just go ahead and do so until the courts say that it's no longer constitutional. You have a duty and responsibility on the ground to say no. That's why the founders put the oath obligation in the Constitution itself.
Right.
They didn't say just do whatever you're told until the Supreme Court says no. You know, it says every officer at a level of government in all branches must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution.
How long? What's the history of that oath, though? Like, what? I mean, a lot of people that probably don't understand or haven't been in the service or were never a law enforcement officer, they may not even understand that oath really actually means anything, or that it has some kind of historical context in terms of holding people accountable for their
actions.
It's
illegal. It's not merely historical. It's not just historical context. It's a legal binding requirement. It's in the supreme law of the land, which is the Constitution itself, in Article 6, it mandates that every officer, all officers in the federal government and the state government, including executive officers, judicial, executive, and legislative, and anybody who's a police officer, for example, is in the executive branch in their state.
Mm-hmm.
They all must take an oath. The Constitution in Article 6 says so straight away. They are required to take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. So that was put in by the founders. It's a legal requirement. It's also, you can call it a moral requirement. There is no law above the Constitution. There's no law outside the Constitution. If it's outside the Constitution, it's not law at all. It's null and void from inception.
Right.
This is something the Supreme Court has reaffirmed in multiple cases. So, but you don't need the Supreme Court to tell you that, because it says so right there in Article 6. The Constitution and the laws made pursuant thereto are the supreme law of the land, period.
Uh-huh.
Nothing else is. The will of the president, the desire of people during emergencies, none of that is the supreme law of the land. And none of those things can influence or should influence a decision by an officer at any level about whether or not the act or the order he's been given is constitutional. That's an individual decision he must make, just the same as he has a decision to make about whether the order he's being given violates the laws of war. It's an individual decision he must make. If he makes the wrong decision, like, for example, in the military, if you refuse orders during wartime and it's ruled later that your orders were lawful, uh-huh. you can be sent to Leavenworth for life or executed, right, for refusing right. a lawful order. But on the same token, you're also in the hot seat if it's ruled later that you followed an unlawful order. You can also wind up at Leavenworth for life or executed. So you're in the hot seat either way if you're in the military. You're right. in the hot seat. You have to make a decision. That's just, every military service member should understand that.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, even in the military, where, post-World War II, we had the Nuremberg trials, trying the Nazis, making it obviously very clear that, just following orders is no defense. Hung them. They said, oh, it's just following orders. Sorry, no defense. There's a higher law. In our country, we have a blatant higher law. There were the Nazis. They had to appeal to, international humanity and notions of international law. But we have a written constitution that's right there in your face. It's right there.
Uh-huh.
So there's an absolute duty. Just as you can't shoot women and children, you also can't violate the Bill of Rights here at home. So when they start running up against the Bill of Rights, the protections of the American people's rights, like they did during Hurricane Katrina, the more the military is used inside the United States, the more important it is for them to understand what the Bill of Rights says, so right. they don't cross those lines.
I agree.
So,
mm-hmm. Well, and then I kind of wonder too, how did we get so wildly off track? If it makes sense that the oath there is supposed to be, a moral compass, a very, very easy to understand moral, this is the decision that's coming down. You're either going to do this or you're going to do not. Is there an agenda to keep that information away from the troops? I mean, are troops even presented with the oath in a way that makes them understand how important it is, or is this just something that we just kind of gloss over nowadays?
I don't think so, and that's the reason for this organization to exist.
Mm-hmm.
Is I think that when you join the military, the first thing you do at the induction center is you're sworn in, you take the oath.
Right.
But after that, not a whole lot is talked about directly saying this is an oath obligation to refuse orders. They talk about the UCMJ, Universal Code of Military Justice, and they talk about what's a lawful order and an unlawful order.
Okay.
So they do teach that, and they'll use Mili or Abu Ghraib. It's now the latest example of things that you should not do.
Right.
But they don't really teach it through the lens of this flows straight from your oath obligation. It's more like you're under UCMJ, and under UCMJ, here's what you can and can't do, And there's some spotty education about, well, you have a right to refuse unlawful orders if they violate the laws of war and UCMJ.
Uh-huh.
But there's not, like I said, not really there's no detailed education on the Constitution, let's put it that way. And the thing goes for police officers. Police officers go through the academy. They're taught some case law, most of it about how you can do pretty much whatever you want to do when
right.
it comes to search and seizure, all the different loopholes around the Fourth Amendment. Inevitable discovery is one of the worst ones, officer safety and Terry stops and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So they learn all this stuff, but they don't really learn about the structure of the Constitution or, once again, that fundamental bedrock obligation and duty to defend it. They're taught that, you're supposed to protect and serve. And a lot of times they'll misstate their own oath. They'll say, I swore an oath to protect the people. It's like, no, you didn't.
No.
That's not what your oath is. A police officer's oath is always to support and defend the Constitution of the United States and the state of whatever.
Right.
Arizona,
right.
Alabama. So they have an obligation to defend both constitutions. And nothing in there about public safety or defending the lives of the people. Nothing like that. Because the founders made the obedience to the supreme law of the land the only obligation. No conflicts.
Right.
Yes, you have duties and responsibilities in your job, but your overarching moral and legal obligation and duty is to defend the Constitution. Well, and the same thing applies to all of us.
Yes.
This is, and you want to know why we're in the position we're in? There's two big reasons why. Yes, there are domestic enemies of the Constitution who have designs to dumb us down and make us think that, well, hey, the Supreme Court decides those things. Don't worry about that.
Right.
You just do what you're told until the Supreme Court says not to. You just obey the orders that are being enforced or being given to you until the Supreme Court says not to. And this gives a pass to everybody. The politicians are the same way, right? In Washington, D.C., do they actually debate the constitutionality of any laws being proposed?
No. That's not their job.
Say, hey,
yeah.
Is it a good job or is it a good idea or a bad idea? And they debate the policy and the supposed outcomes. And they say, well, the Supreme Court will determine later on review whether or not, you know, someday if someone files a case and the Supreme Court happens to grant cert, we'll find out if it's unconstitutional. Till then, party hardy. You
know, right.
They just make whatever law they want. Well, so that's partly the elite's fault, but the other blame is on us. We should all go look in the mirror.
Uh-huh.
That's who's responsible, because the American people, with few exceptions, important exceptions, of course, but few, the American people tend to just vote party first, number one. Out of fear of the lesser of two evils, they will put a known oath breaker back in office over and over and over again. How else can you explain John McCain or Lindsey Graham?
Oh, no doubt. You know, oh, my gosh.
Or Hillary Clinton or any of these people on
right.
both sides of the political spectrum.
Right.
The so-called left or right. They're all oath breakers. This is the problem. Is the founders, they built a system that where they, I think they screwed up, frankly. Because they trusted that they assume there'd be a majority of oath keepers or people who would keep their oath in public office.
Mm-hmm.
And so be the majority of the good guys having to police the few bad guys. That's where impeachment would come in for the president or for judges. And in Congress, under the rules of Article I, Congress has the authority to discipline any member of Congress. So, you know, theoretically, if they're all, the great majority of them were, you know, like Ron Paul, oath keepers, and there's only a couple of oath breakers, they could just purge them right out of Congress.
Right.
Well, the problem is it's upside down.
Right.
The vast majority of them are all oath breakers.
Mm-hmm.
People ask me sometimes, well, why don't they just impeach Obama? Why would any of these people who are also oath breakers want to impeach a fellow oath breaker? They're all in the same club.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so the Republicans are never going to impeach Obama on the grounds that he's violating the Constitution. This is not going to happen.
Mm-mm.
Because most of them, you know, they're in the same club. They agree. They agree on the fundamental big picture. They'll argue and debate supposedly about differences on really minor things compared to the big picture, which is that they can rule with absolute impunity. And if you want to challenge them, your only recourse, according to them, is through the political system, voting them out. Good luck
right.
with that,
right.
with gerrymandering and voter fraud and all this stuff, you know, vote fraud. Or you got to go to the courts. You got to go hat in hand to the Supreme Court, a gaggle of friggin' lawyers in dresses appointed by the elites themselves. That's your only recourse.
Well,
no,
I got to interject a little bit here because I have a lot of questions for you just regarding, you know, we have law enforcement. They take an oath to the state. I'm of the opinion that the state is a fictional creation of the minds of men. It's a corporate entity these days, and I think there's a lot of evidence out there to suggest that. You could probably say the same thing about the United States generally right now, is that all of these little alphabet agencies, the Treasury, all these people – are corporate entities. They are trying to make a profit. And so, you know, going to, like, talking about the court system, you know, I have a good friend of mine, John, here, who lives in Missouri, in the 13th district, which is the largest district in Missouri. There's 13 judges in that district. Not one of them in the last year has been able to provide evidence that they ever took an oath. So we're in this situation right now where there has been a corporate structure overlaid over the legal system, over everything that's going on, and we don't have any recourse anymore. And these people are taking oaths to support that exact initiative, in my opinion. You know what I mean? It seems like they are hell-bent on upholding the, you know, the rules of the state, which gets them into where they can oppress people for money and, you know, victimless crime and things like that. It's like we're in upside down land, Stuart, you know?
Well, we are. And I don't really believe there's a silver bullet. I don't think you're going to be able to, like, I've had people across the country. They're like, you know, I'm demanding that they produce their oath, you know, and things like that.
Right.
Okay, fine. But you're still inside the system. They're never going to say, oh, you got us. You know, I didn't have my oath properly filed. They're not going to care about things like that.
Well,
so to me, what's going to matter in the end, if we're in the same situation as the founding fathers of that generation was leading up to the American Revolution. We're in a situation where what's going to matter is, one, the hearts and minds of your fellow Americans, the perceived legitimacy of their side or our side. That matters. Two, though, what matters is physical structure. Do you have a strong community? And look at the founders' ideal of a free state. What does the Second Amendment say is necessary for the security of a free state?
Weapons.
A well-regulated militia, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's necessary. As a, you know, so Dr. Edwin Vieira has been doing a series of articles and books all about this, and he's right. And this is the Liberty Movement very rarely focuses on this. He talks about two great deficiencies we have. One, no sound money.
Right.
And two, no militia. The no sound money is important because we're going to head for an economic collapse. It's going to happen. There's no such thing as a fiat currency in the history of the world that ever survives.
Right.
It always goes back to its actual worth, which is zero. So it's going to happen. You can look at Weimar Germany. You can look at Argentina. You can look at the Balkans. You can use other examples in history. Zimbabwe doesn't make a difference. That's what's going to happen to this country eventually. And because of that, we're going to be thrown into discord and chaos and emergency. Unless we're prepared. And being prepared means also not just gold and silver, which would be great, you know, if you can store away some real wealth, but also food. I mean, it's going to be potentially chaos. People starved, and like during the Weimar collapse, for example, even when there was food out in the fields in rural areas, the farmers had food, but they didn't ship to the city. Why would they want to? Why would they want to ship actual wealth,
right,
the food, to the city in exchange for, you know, fiat currency,
wallpaper,
worthless.
Yeah.
So yeah, they didn't do it. So people in the city had to go out to the farms with bags of the family silver and grand pianos on the back of a cart and all kinds of stuff to try to get a bag of potatoes.
Hmm.
So this is the problem. So, but under that kind of situation, when you have that kind of collapse, Vieira pointed out, the other big deficiency is lack of a militia. And a militia provides security. It provides security in the hands of the people.
Mm-hmm.
Professional police, like professional military, really should not exist in this republic.
Oh man,
the
preacher
founders,
to the choir.
Right, the founders were very suspicious and fearful of a standing army,
mm-hmm,
because it's a select body of men separate from the people who are professionally attached to being, you know, lifetime soldiers. They're more likely to follow orders. That's why they didn't like that.
Mm-hmm.
They thought that every now and again you might have to raise an army, but for the most part, you relied on your militia, which is made up of the people themselves, right? That's who provides security. Well, the same goes for professional police. It's the same problem. This is why, you know, it's unlikely. I'm not saying we can't try, but it's unlikely that the great majority of police officers in service today are going to refuse orders because their pension, their whole career, their paycheck,
right,
is all wrapped around saying yes.
Yeah.
We've seen it over and over again.
I think the only hope I have is that eventually they're going to realize that their families are out in the streets still, and, you know, and they're just as under threat as the rest of us are. And eventually,
right,
they're not going to get paid, you know, eventually they're going to have to decide, okay, well, I'm not going to get paid to go out and keep,
right,
you know,
well, that's what's going to happen during a collapse. Right.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, and this is already happening across the country in some small towns. The tax base is disappearing because of the crash of the economy,
mm-hmm,
and they're having to fire the officers. And so the answer is always going to wind up being you and your neighbors taking responsibility,
yes,
for yourselves.
Yes.
So you can wait until the chaos hits and then have to like scramble to put together some kind of, you know, ad hoc neighborhood militia or, you know, neighborhood watch, whatever you want to call it. Or you can get it together ahead of time now during normal times,
mm-hmm,
you know, during peacetime. So the founders, in their wisdom, said we should have a militia at all times. And it should be made up of the people themselves, well-regulated, which meant well-equipped and well-trained and organized.
Right, right.
So we don't have that. So those are the things we really must get back to.
Well, just think of how well we've done with voluntary firefighters out in rural areas. Yeah. There's no reason we couldn't have voluntary. Yeah, exactly. So there's no reason we couldn't have voluntary peace officers that were, you know, well supervised, but
Some places do.
Oh,
and
really?
Some do. So, sure. Yeah. Some places have police auxiliary and reserves, and you can have a sheriff's posse. I mean, a sheriff's posse. So the ideal would be an elected sheriff, which we have in most places in the United States.
Right.
But then his reliance should be not on a large staff of full-time officers, but instead on the people themselves as the posse. That's the people wearing the law enforcement hat saying, okay. So when you have like the Boston bombing suspect, right, running around Watertown, Massachusetts, and everyone's losing their minds, the answer there should have been for the neighborhoods to turn out. But they know who belongs and who doesn't. They know they know their own ground.
Mm-hmm.
Who else is going to find them? And that's who wanted to find the guy, right? It wasn't some SWAT officer. It was a guy that noticed his boat cover was askew.
Exactly.
And looked in the boat and saw the guy. That's how he got found anyway. So all that heavy-handed police state nonsense, pointing guns and pointing rifles at families and having it come out of the house like they were Jews in Nazi Germany, all of that did no good at all to find that guy. None of it did. It was a homeowner who found him. So, you know, we got to get back to the founder's ideal. You don't sit like a little sheep in your pen waiting for the sheepdogs to go find the wolf. You get out and you go find them and you protect yourself. That's how it needs to be.
And
the same goes for the military aspect of the militia.
I love it. I tell you, we have that exact conversation here on Red Pill Reports all the time. The first change takes place in your heart, then the next one takes place in your family, and then the next one takes place in your community. And if we can get everybody to that level, eventually we're going to be an interconnected nation of self-sufficient, well-regulated communities, which I think even Gandhi said was probably the best way to go. So I'm completely with you. We are going to have to take a break here in just a few seconds here, Mr. Rhodes, but I do want to come back. I know a lot of people think about the Oath Keepers as you guys are kind of like a one-trick pony. This, you know, when the gun confiscations start, that's when you guys are going to be out in the streets. But that's not at all true.
No.
You guys are doing so much to get communities ready and stuff like that. So I definitely want to get into some of those reasons that I want people to go to oathkeepers.org and support you guys when we come back from this break. And I definitely want to talk about, I know you guys have some pretty big community preparedness type programs going on. And I'm definitely curious about your thoughts on jury nullification also, because I'm of the opinion that that's one of the things that if we could get back under our grasp, that we could really make do some damage against these illegal law enforcement people. What do you think about jury nullification for just a second before we go to a break?
Oh, fully in support of it. I mean, that's what a jury's for.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's
no other rational purpose for a jury. A jury, it's the same as the militia. It is the people themselves taking the power into their own hands of judgment, critical power. The jury and the militia are the two most important institutions we have.
Right, roger that. Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, as I said, we are going to go take a quick 3-minute break. Stuart Rhodes is my guest. Oathkeepers.org. Please, please go and support Oathkeepers. Oh my goodness, there's like so few organizations out there actually doing something for the benefit of humanity and the benefit of our country, and this is one of them. And I just definitely want you guys to go to Oathkeepers.org. We're going to go to this quick 3-minute break. We'll be right back. Keep it right here, guys.
Yeah, I gotta get a radio show.
Hey, Big Mouth. Yeah, you. Listen, I want you to put the word out on the street. Tell your coworkers, your family, your paisanos, that my good friend, Joe Joseph, is doing a good thing here. He's sticking his neck out for me, for Sil, and for all the people in the world. Isn't that right, Sil?
He's part of the family now, Dave.
That's what I thought. So tune in to him right here on Freedom Link, Monday to Friday, exclusively on the Truth Frequency Radio. Yeah, they're watching you. Big deal. They're watching me, too. They're watching everybody. So grow some cojones and give them something to watch and listen to. Make them earn it. Give them paperwork until they choke. That's right. I know you won't let me down. So you're going to put the word out about my good friend, Joe Joseph, right? Good. Now do me a favor and get out of here.
After work, I'm so tired that I want to be left alone to sleep.
Hey, listen to me.
Who are you?
I'm you years ago when you felt healthy and young and everything worked on your body. Do you remember that?
Yes. I wish I felt like that now.
You can feel like that again with a new microplant powder formulation called Iodine Now. It cleans the entire body from head to toe and feeds the body what it really needs. You'll be in a better mood and you'll find more drive in your romantic life. Really? I gotta try Iodine Now and feel good again. It also protects you from radiation, heavy metals, fluoride, chlorine, and bromine, including cancer and most major diseases. You'll be amazed. You can be your own doctor. I want to keep you out of the hospital and off pharmaceuticals. Wow, why are you so nice to me? Because I'm you. You're out of shape, and I need a better-looking future.
Call 888-910-4367. That's 888-910-4367. Iodine Now, only at MUSA.org.
Here at MyPatriotSupply.com, our customers are number one. Built on a self-sustaining business model, we don't owe our existence to big banks or big business. Instead, the company was built by you, the customer. The success of My Patriot Supply is a testimony to the loyalty and dedication of each and every one of you, to our old-fashioned values and top-rated customer service. These elements alone have made us the number one choice of patriots everywhere. We believe that being prepared should not be a luxury reserved by people with large disposable incomes, which is why we have the products you need at the prices you can afford. We bring you our Patriot Pantry brand of storable food, which features top-of-the-line flavors and carefully packed to store for 25 years. Plus water purification systems, non-GMO heirloom seeds, survival gear, and much, much more. Visit MyPatriotSupply.com or call 866-229-0927. That's 866-229-0927. MyPatriotSupply.com.
X-Squared Radio with Brooks Atkins.
Sundays on True Frequency Radio.
It's Monday. We're having a good time. Stuart Rhodes is our guest. We're talking about oathkeepers.org. Again, probably one of the only organizations out there that we would, I would give you guys the shirt off of my back. Honestly, Stuart, you guys are just so profound in what you guys have been able to do. And I know my father is a huge fan of yours, so I know he's listening to the program right now. Before we went to the break, we were talking about the Oath Keepers and what you guys are doing kind of right now in terms of bolstering community preparedness. So I'm wondering if you could tell the listeners how they can get involved with you guys and what you guys are doing to help get some of our communities, you know, like you said, more prepared for a pending collapse or prepared for anything that might come down the pike.
Right. Well, we started what we call our Community Preparedness Team Project, CPT. And what that is just encouraging our membership to lead by example and to then turn around and encourage the veterans to do the same and say, look, you've got training. The military trained you. You know, the American people have trained you through their tax dollars. You have a duty and obligation to pass on that training and that experience and help organize your neighbors. Like you said earlier, it starts with you and your family. It's your first team.
Yep.
You know, in your family, like we have a five critical areas of skill sets. One is like emergency communications. The other one is emergency medical. The third one is emergency engineering, like clean water and alternate power and heat, things like that that you're going to need. And then another major prong is security. So, and then the last one is preparedness, general preparedness, including food storage and how to grow your own food, things like that. Mm-hmm. Those are all critical areas that we know we need to have squared away. So in your own family, do you have that? Do you have emergency communications? Is someone in your family like a ham radio operator and knows how to communicate? Do you have emergency medical? Are you guys trained at least to the combat lifesaver level of being able to put a tourniquet on and stop major trauma and, you know, pack a wound and put a pressure bandage on? So, you know, do you have emergency medical inside your own family? Uh-huh. Engineering, do you know how to turn off the gas? Do you know how to turn off the power if you need to? Do you have an alternate way to sanitize water? Do you have alternative sanitation in case that the sewer system backs up? You know, do you have these things squared away? So this is, you think about it, this is the kind of stuff that whenever you see a disaster like Katrina, what they wind up dropping by the pallet load off of helicopters? Clean water, right?
Yep.
Medical supplies, radios, blankets. So these are the things you're going to need in an emergency anyway. So why not in advance say, okay, here's what I'm going to need, not just the gear, but also the training.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of preppers out there, they get so focused on gear. It's all gear, 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 gear. Well, training trumps gear. That's a good saying from On Point Tactical, a place I've gone and done some training with.
Right.
Kevin Reeves of On Point Tactical says, training trumps gear. It's more important than the gear, training being able to use it. But community trumps both, because you can't do everything. So that's why you need to reach out beyond your family to your neighbors, because you're going to have a guy down the street who's a retired EMT. You're going to have the retired nurse, the retired firefighter. You know, it's like the old Sesame Street thing. These are the people in your neighborhood.
Right.
You're in your neighborhood. But we don't friggin' know it because we don't even know each other. No one talks to your neighbor. No one has any idea what skill sets you already have.
Mm-hmm.
I'll guarantee you, if you were to go and walk around the neighborhood and find out, hey, what'd you do for a living? Were you in the military? Were you some kind of a first responder? Whatever it is, a guy who was in construction his whole life, that's a friggin' engineer.
Right.
He can build probably anything or run generators. You know, there's guys like that are golden. Whether they were trained as a combat engineer or not, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. I would put them in the engineering slot. They can help you figure out how to keep warm and how to keep things going. So you're already in your neighborhood, so you got to reach out and talk to your neighbors and find out what you got there. And do it through whatever mechanisms you can. A really vanilla one we still have available to us is the Neighborhood Watch. It's a system, you know, almost every community has a Neighborhood Watch officer in the department who is assigned the task of handling the creation of Neighborhood Watches.
Right.
Now, they're pretty watered down usually. It's like, oh, you see something, say something, you know, and it turns into like a spy network for your community.
Right.
But why not take that? It's kind of like jiu-jitsu, right? They've given us this vanilla watered down thing. Great, let's just use it. Okay, great. I'm going to start a Neighborhood Watch. Or even CERT. You know, some people don't like CERT because it's under FEMA. But you get free training, and you can walk up to your neighbors and say, hi, I'm a certified CERT person, and FEMA has trained me, you know.
Hmm.
And neighbors go, oh, okay, he's one of the good guys. You know what I mean?
Right.
So, you know, it's the same thing as like joining the volunteer fire department. I think you should join the volunteer fire department, your search and rescue, police auxiliary, a posse if you have one, whatever is already there, go join it, become part of it. That way you're part of the first responder community when you go and knock on your neighbor's door, because most people get scared by private citizens daring to do anything on their own. But if you have a mantle of approval from the system, they're more likely to listen to you and,
right,
and see you as a good guy. So if I walk in the door and say, hi, I'm you know, Joe Blow, I'm with the local volunteer fire department, I just want to introduce myself and say, here's my phone number. How do I reach you in case I see your house on fire? How do I reach you in case I see your door kicked in during the day? You know, and by the way, I'm serving a neighborhood watch. I'm working with Officer Friday down here at the department, blah, blah, blah.
Wow.
They see you as part of the system, and they're, you know, it's okay.
Right.
And then you get them to at least give you their contact info. You're offering them a service. You're not asking for anything from them. But while you're talking, you're like, hey, yeah, you know, what kind of work are you into? And you find out who they are. And you're kind of shopping for talent. Then you can come back later. And you could say, yeah, we talked to you the other day. I'm the Joe Blow with the fire department and start a neighborhood watch. And how you doing? You know, great.
Uh-huh.
Hey, you used to be a firefighter, or you used to be, you know, a CB in the military, or whatever the whatever their skill set is. If things happened, could I rely on you? Could you help me
right
in this neighborhood to do those things, whatever it is? And if you had a retired nurse or retired doctor, I would put together, even if they're not interested, and I'm retired, and I don't want to be any part of that, great. You put together the gear they're going to need to patch people up, and you store it for them. So
right,
when the time comes, you've got it. And so even if all your neighbors are just bumps on the log and don't do much, you can say, okay, three or four or five people, maybe two or three families in an area, you form the core that gets ready for everybody else. You store up extra radios, extra batteries, maybe some extra, you know, water purification systems, whatever. And when the time comes, you can hand those out to your neighbors, and now you can put together security. Because communications, for example, is really hard to improvise. Either you got it or you don't.
Right.
So, you know, even something as simple as a few CB radios that you can plug into someone's car and a cigarette lighter so that they can go on a patrol and let you know what they see. You know,
uh-huh.
During the riots we had in Ferguson, right? Look at that. There were some locals there who did go and protect neighborhood businesses on, you know, kind of on the fly, got together and said, hey, we're going to make sure that, you know, this guy's place doesn't burn because we like this guy.
Right.
There were some young black men that did that. They went and protected a gas station owned by a white man because they liked and respected him. There were a few like that. but not enough, right? We had to send our volunteers in from out of state to go guard a whole block of buildings. And we shouldn't have had to do that. People of Ferguson should have had it handled.
Did you guys
get a warm welcome?
Did you guys get a warm welcome when you got there?
Of course we. Well, among the business owners, absolutely. And the people that lived there are people living in those apartments above the businesses. It's one thing a lot of folks don't understand.
Right.
There were residences above them. So it wasn't just about property. It was also about lives. So if those buildings had been burned by arsonists, we could have died, could have been burned to death, entire families. So they're very grateful. The anarchists, or so-called anarchists, the lefties who were, you know, friggin' communists, the agitators that were there didn't like us, obviously.
Well, and
they want to maximize the chaos.
It seemed like the media was kind of, I saw a lot of media reports, you know, that were not really pro Oathkeeper when all those events were going down.
Compared with the usual, like, it was actually pretty good press.
Oh, really?
You know? Yeah. Well, I mean, it's kind of hard. How do you twist guys protecting businesses and apartments against arsonists? How do you twist that into something bad? It's harder to do.
Yeah.
They still try.
Yeah. So, wow.
But we shouldn't have had to, the point though is that we should not have had to have called on veterans from as far away as Maine and Nebraska to go guard those buildings. It's a fail on the part of the people of Ferguson. Mm-hmm. They should have been organized into their own militia of all the people in the town under the authority of their town council or whatever. They should have had a real militia. Then when the governor says, hey, you need to not protect your own homes, they could have told them to go pound sand.
Right.
But they were relying instead on what you would call a select militia, which is the National Guard of Missouri, mm-hmm. who were not all from, you know what I mean? Not hardly any from Ferguson, probably. And so they were told just go over there and guard the government buildings only and don't guard those places over there.
That's boy, and there good. there were a lot of people who were really upset about that too. Say, oh, the National Guard should have been protecting, should have been there to protect against the arsonists. It's like, no, well, the National Guard is there to protect government infrastructure. That's what their job is. And that's what they did. And why people were so upset about that. I was like, they're not, the continuity of government plan, ladies and gentlemen, doesn't have anything to do with the continuity of your well-being. It has to do with the continuity of government. They don't care about you under any circumstances whatsoever. You know, but
absolutely.
Stuart, here's the deal.
And that ties in with the big picture point.
Right.
Back to the jury again. Mm-hmm. Why is it that the founders insisted on the right to trial by jury? Because it's too important a job to delegate to someone else. You don't have a professional jury of a few people who decide everyone's fate when the local prosecutor decides to railroad you.
Right.
You don't have a judge to decide your fate. No one in the government decides your fate. Only a jury of your peers can take away your life or your liberty. It's a critical power that has to stay in the hands of the people. Well, the physical power, the physical security to protect yourselves is the same thing. It has to be in your own hands, and not just for private criminals. And the second, this is what drives me crazy about a lot of gun owners. They're like, yes, I believe in the Second Amendment. I have a right to defend myself against, you know, drug addicts and rapists and murderers. And in case of constitutional emergency, break glass. Someday we may have to, you know, fight against the government.
Right.
Missing the whole friggin' point. The point is, there should be no massive standing army. There should be no massive standing army of police. There should be no National Guard of select militia who are sent overseas like a reserve for the army.
Mm-hmm.
It should be you and your neighbors at all times. Wearing both hats, your law enforcement, that's under the posse, and your military under the militia. So no one can misuse those powers against you.
Uh-huh.
They can't do what was done in Ferguson and strip you of your protection because you are your own protection. They also can't use them against you because you are them. If that's the founder's answer to that ancient question of who shall guard the guardians, is you must be your own guardians. Just like you must be your own judges when it comes to judging each other in the jury.
Yeah.
Your guilt or innocence and judging the lawfulness of the act, right?
Yeah.
Whether or not it's a constitutional law is a question for the jury, right? They have the right to judge the law as well as the facts.
I'm of the opinion that
always been that way.
Isn't that the reason that we have Pennsylvania? Wasn't William Penn on trial for, I think it was blasphemy, which was at the time punishable
back
by death?
Back in England, right.
Right. And
right.
one of the bunch of jurors said, no, we don't think he can, you know, be as religious in whatever way he wants to be. And they, you know, they cut down the law instead of cutting down the man.
They nullified. That's right. Mm-hmm. And the same goes for the Zangler trial. The Zangler trial is a famous trial in colonial America in the United States of a newspaper editor who was tried for libel, because under English law back then, libel was not a false statement. Libel was even the truth against a government official that might taint his reputation.
Right.
Well, the jury disagreed with the law. They said, we don't care what the dang law is. He has a right to free speech. Go stuff it. And they nullified. So this is like you said, bedrock in American history, in legal history. And, you know, there's like, you can go find law review articles in Yale Law School and Harvard that lay out, yeah, this is the power of a jury. That's what a jury does. Mm-hmm. And the Supreme Court has even ruled that, yes, the jury has this power. They can do this. But then they say, but they don't have the right to do this. And so we don't have to tell you. So it just, you know, this is what lawyers do. This is what judges do. They can always find a way to, you know, quote unquote, make it legal. So the judges now, yes, you have the power, but we don't have to tell you. So they lie to you and tell you must follow the instructions of the judge when it's not true and they know it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a mess.
And
so,
woe is be the juror who brings up the concept of jury nullification. I tell everybody all the time, if you want to get out of jury duty, that's the quickest way to do it. Just go in there and ask the judge if they're going to allow jury nullification. If you don't get put in contempt, you definitely won't be on jury duty for that particular trial.
But don't do that.
Don't do that.
I would prefer that you be a guerrilla juror and go in there and do your responsibility. You shouldn't be trying to get out of jury duty. You should be doing everything you can to get on a jury so you can nullify.
Yes.
Okay? You need to get back in there.
So
nullification is critical. And hey, nullification goes at every level. It's not just the jury. It's the beat cop saying, no, I'm not going to enforce this. It's the prosecutor saying, no, I'm not going to prosecute. Mm-hmm. It's the judge throwing the case out. There's safeguards throughout the system. And every level of government has a responsibility to say no. The county commissioners, the town councilmen, all of them have a duty to say no. I mean, Jefferson and Madison told us, right, in the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions, in response to the Alien Sedition Act back in 1798, they said, hey, this stuff is blatantly unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm.
You have a duty, Mr. Legislator in the state, to say no. And further, to interpose yourself and protect the people under your, you know, your sovereigns, the people in your community who you swore, you know, to defend the Constitution, you swore to defend it, you must do so. And so you have a duty to interpose and nullify.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and so that's what we have to get back to. It's not just politics, conventionally understood, of voting. It's also, hey, we're gonna pass resolutions, we're gonna nullify, we're gonna condemn. Like you're seeing now in New York. There are sheriffs in New York, oathkeeper sheriffs, and members of CSPOA, you know, Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officer Association, mm-hmm. started by Sheriff Mack, really good organization too. There are sheriffs saying, hey, we're not going to enforce the SAFE Act. Their entire towns saying the SAFE Act is null and void. Their entire counties doing that now in New York. So you're seeing it happen in New York right now. So that's what you need more of.
I agree.
But they have to be backed up with teeth, though. You can't just say, well, here's a piece of paper that says we're not going to do this. You need to have a posse, and you need to have, you know, behind that good sheriff, and you need a militia too.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's funny because we're talking about this creation of, like, you know, neighborhood militias, which I don't even want to call it a militia, because I think that's one of our problems, is that word has been so stigmatized. We've lost the right.
It's the M word.
Yeah,
it's like the M word, but now it's the M word. Right.
But we were talking about with the neighborhood watch thing. I'm not that old, Stuart. I'm not even 40 yet, and I can remember growing up here in St. Louis, outside of St. Louis. And I had a drawer in my kitchen that had every key to every front door, that I had friends at houses of friends or neighbors. I had both my next door neighbors' keys. I had neighbors across the street's keys. Everybody knew everybody. And we weren't militiaizing. We were barbecuing. But at the same time, that community felt like there was nothing that could have happened in that community without us getting a phone call or, you know what I mean? And how are we so far away from that now? It's crazy to me.
Well, part of it is the demonization of the militia. I mean, like you said, and part of the blame, of course, are the elites who are afraid of that. They don't want it, and so they want to demonize. No matter how you do it, they're going to demonize it.
Right.
But the other side of it is that also a lot of the people in the militia movements of the 90s might have had good intentions, but they really screwed it up. You know, a lot of these guys, I've seen it for decades. A lot of them have never even served in the military, have no training, which is fine, but then they give themselves a title like, you know, colonel or general.
Right.
And guys who are actual veterans look at that and go, who is this guy?
Right.
You know, who gave you your commission? Where'd you go? What military academy did you go to become a general? You know,
mm-hmm.
it's just like, who is this clown? And they they look at that and go, okay, this guy's a clown. And most of them, a lot of them are clowns. There's some good people in private militias, but a lot of them are clowns and wannabes. And they tend to spoil it for us. They tend to make it look like a bunch of clowns, and everyone's like, oh, look, see? And they're easy to attack. They're low-hanging fruit for our, you know, Southern Poverty Law Center and other enemies of the militia system. So, you know, so how do you get around that? That's what we're trying to do. We say, okay, let's pick the veterans who are credible, who have the training, and we say, okay, it's not that we're going to be your protectors, like we're, you know, same kind of sheepdog. I hate that sheepdog paradigm of you're a sheep and I'm a sheepdog. It's not that way, not that way at all. But I have training that I need to pass on to you. So I'll give you credible training that's no nonsense, that's real deal. We put together teams to go and train the community. And they go train neighborhood watchers. Like right now in Montana, my own personal town, we've got a CPT team, community preparedness team. Mm-hmm. And we have on it three nurses. We've got two different retired firefighters. We've got a guy who was a carpenter his whole life. He's on the engineering team. Even if they're not prior military, they have credible skill sets. They are experts in their own little field. I was infantry, everyone infantry. We got a couple other infantry guys there, one recent returning Iraq veteran. They're very credible in their field. And so we all get together and we can say, look, this is a credible team. It's not Walter Mitty wannabes or posers. These people know what they're doing. Then they each teach in their own skill set to the community, turn around and teach classes to the community, mm-hmm. and we teach for free. And so, but the real goal is not for us to be like the team for the town. This is another reason why the militia system, the militia movement has kind of screwed up. Is they'll get together like a dozen guys and they'll say, we are the militia of this county.
Right.
And it's like, no, you're not. The militia would be everybody in the county, every able-bodied person. That would be a real militia. Okay. So until it gets to that point, I don't think it deserves that title. And I would also prefer to have some kind of sanction from the people's representatives in the town council or the county commissioners if you can get it. And the reason you want that is you need to have the military power being subservient to the civil power. So even if you wind up like in the Founders' Day, they started their own shadow or alternate, you know, patriot governments, that's probably what's going to wind up happening in this country. The political system as it is right now is so corrupt, you're probably not going to be able to revamp your county government. Good luck. Go ahead and try it. Mm-hmm. But across the country, it's going to be very spotty, right? So, but you need some kind of sanction from the people. And to start, I would say, if you can get your church groups and your veterans halls and other civic organizations in your community to all get on board, the more widespread it is and the more participation you can get from your average Joes, the more legitimacy it has and the more rightful legitimacy, I think, to call itself a militia because it's made up of the people themselves. See what I'm saying?
I do,
like Oath Keepers is going to be like the team for the town, huh? Our goal is to be trainers. That's why we use the SF-18 model. We can do things like we did in Ferguson, go and do it ourselves if we have to. But what we really are is a training cadre. And the ground zero is your family and then that neighborhood watch. That neighborhood watch, to me, is the most fundamental element. Because even if you wind up later on with a posse behind a good sheriff or a county militia that can go out and project out and to defend the whole community, you still got to have security in your neighborhood.
Yes.
If your home is not secure, no one's going to go out. No EMT, no firefighter, no police officer, no militia man. Mm-hmm. Nobody's going to go out and leave their home if their wife and kids are not safe.
I completely agree. And, you know, one of the points I want to make, and I make a lot also, is that if we do get into some kind of total collapse type situation, you know, your local, I live in a little town, Stuart. There's probably 3,500 people in my town. So we have, you know, six cops and they're municipal cops. They all drive $100,000 cop cars and everything. But at the end of the day, they all live in my community and I've made it a point to go out and introduce myself to each one of them. They know who I am and I know who they are. Because at the end of the day, if something bad happens, those are going to be the guys that are out on foot patrol. Those are going to be the guys that are out trying to do what's right for their family and yours. And I think that it's important to recognize
there's only six of them, right?
There's only six of them. Yeah.
No, they're not going to be the guys doing jack. You know,
oh, you don't think
it?
So?
It's going to, no. There's only six of them. If there's actual social breakdown, it's going to be you and your neighbors out on patrol. That's who's going to be out on patrol.
Right.
Go look at any hurricane in American history and the aftermath of it. What do you wind up seeing? You see guys standing on their lawns with shotguns and rifles protecting the neighborhood.
Right.
That's what you're going to see.
But you don't think that these guys, because they're local, will be in that boat also and
But there's only six of them. What are they going to do?
Well,
they can't secure you guys. I mean, come on, get past that.
Okay.
Yes, great. It's nice that they're nice guys. Wonderful, but there's only six of them. You know, I mean, there's only like two on patrol at any one time, right?
Right.
That's it.
Well, I was just trying to recommend that people don't forget about the fact that there are other guys in the community that are already, you know, and while you're looking for your neighbors, it might be worth reaching out to your local law enforcement too and telling them what you're doing and seeing if they can interact
with that.
Yeah, of course.
Like I said, go ahead, you know, go ahead and tap into the neighborhood watch system. Go to your local PD and say, hey, who's the officer here who handles neighborhood watches? Oh, we don't have one. Well, who would it be? And go talk to them. Because then you're using that system that already exists. You're strengthening it and using it for good.
Right.
So, yes, of course. And if you have a reserve deputy program and you can get some of your neighbors to go join that, by all means, like I said earlier, strengthen whatever's there, but don't rely on that. That structure is an artificial structure, okay?
Okay.
There were no professional police in this country until the late 1880s, when you had large, like New York and large Chicago, large police departments sprang up. Before that, it was constables, it was, you know, the elected sheriff and his part-time deputies, and a lot of places still is. Like volunteer fire department, you know, half the country, most people don't know this, but half the departments in the country for fire are volunteer fire departments.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, half of them are.
Hmm.
Staffed by volunteers. I was one in Montana for a year, and I'm probably going to join my volunteer fire department in the town I live in now.
Right.
But they're there. That's why they exist, because they can't afford to pay professionals, so they rely on volunteers. And the same thing's going to happen in any kind of crisis. I mean, look at the Ferguson thing. Imagine if there had been civil unrest in your area. Those six cops would have been overwhelmed.
Right.
There's never going to be enough cops. You know, even in a police state, it's not enough police to secure you. And as you said earlier, the big picture point is for the most part, governments don't care about the people themselves anyway.
Right.
And that's why, and they have no obligation. You know that too. There's no legal obligation for them to protect you.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't exist.
They don't even have to understand the law anymore, apparently, as of the Supreme Court decision a couple of weeks ago. They can,
as long as they have a good faith,
a good faith misunderstanding. I thought I was doing the right thing, you know.
Yeah, it's so there you go. They're being absolved of all responsibility. So that's why it comes down to individual moral understanding of their obligation that, look, even though the Supreme Court says I can pretty much do whatever I want, I'm not going to do that. And you need to hold them accountable and say, I don't care what the Supreme Court says. We don't care. We consider this illegitimate. We consider this unconstitutional. We're going to hold you accountable in this community. And it might mean, if I was living in a town where the police were like where I live, there's actually no cops, actually. We live in a town with no police officers.
Wow.
Because we don't need them.
Right.
This is rural Montana. Like,
okay.
Like 600 people in my town. We have a volunteer fire department because we need that, but we don't have any cops because we just don't need them.
Yeah. So who writes all your speeding tickets and traffic sign violations?
I don't know. It's absolute chaos.
It's got to be.
Cars are flying off the road. And they're in the trees. You know, they're all over the place.
Right.
People hanging everywhere. So, yeah. So what's really kind of funny is, like, I actually live in a pretty anarchist community. It's really, really interesting because it's a bunch of old Vietnam veterans who wanted to get away from civilization. It's where I live, up in the hills.
Wow, I may have to come seek you guys out there because I'm looking for a place that's like
that. But the point is, if I live in a town where the police are disobeying the Constitution, I'd probably go to the town council meeting and say, you know what, we'll just defund, get rid of the police department if you guys keep going down this road.
Okay.
You know, de-incorporate the town and get rid of the town too.
Right. Well,
keep at it.
Stuart, we are, I'm afraid, out of time for the day. Thank you so much for joining us on the program today, sir.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Everybody go check out oathkeepers.org and please throw some
Truth Frequency Radio is your number one source for news and information. Without the hate, hype, and fear, we are proud to bring you cutting-edge programs like The Kev Baker Show,
The Christopher Everard Show,
The Freedom Link with Joe Joseph,
Truth Frequency with Chris and Shuri Geo,
Red Pill Reports
with J.D. Moore,
X-Squared with Brooks Agnew,
Down the Rabbit Hole with Popeye,
Freaky Friday
with The Woo Crew,
Waking Up the Masses
with Robert Bruce,
Phoenix Rising Radio,
and dozens more.
Did you know you can listen from any computer, mobile device, or from any telephone by dialing 832-225-5308.
Or call into your favorite show toll-free at 866-37-TRUTH.
Uncensored talk and news you won't hear in the mainstream media.
24 hours a day.
Truth Frequency Radio. Wherever you are, make it TFR.
Truth Frequency Radio.